America Looks Abroad. This is the 35th in a series of broadcasts presented by the staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. Today's subject is the new order in France. The speaker is Mr. David H. Popper, research associate of the Foreign Policy Association. Mr. Popper.
Good afternoon. This is Bastille Day, national holiday of the French Republic, which used to be celebrated with parades, oratory, dancing in the streets. Today, externally at least, it is not very much more than just another Sunday for most Frenchmen. Although the war still rages undiminished around its Atlantic and Mediterranean borders, France has already begun to reorganize itself for a part in post-war Europe. On July 9th, the French Chamber of Deputies and Senate voted themselves out of existence by passing a resolution giving Marshal Pétain and his government power to create a new charter for the French state. On the following day, both houses of the French Parliament met together in a joint session as a national assembly under the terms of the old French Constitution of 1875. This assembly has full power to amend the Constitution. There at Vichy, it formally assented to adoption of a constitution abandoning liberty, equality, fraternity as a slogan, and substituting a new trilogy, the rights of labor, family, and fatherland. What these so-called rights are, we do not yet know. Thus, a few Frenchmen were given authority to shape the destiny of the new France, subject only to the approval of the French people, in a plebiscite to be held at some unspecified date. The new constitution was duly put into force by Marshal Pétain as chief of the French state on July 12. Just as in the case of Adolf Hitler's rise to power, all the necessary changes have been made by ostensibly legal means. Since the leaders of the French government profess to be setting up a new order in France, the laws they have framed and the theories they have adopted deserve examination. Under the Constitution, Philippe Pétain, using the royal we like any absolute monarch, assumed the function of chief of the French state, ruling with almost unlimited authority. He appoints the cabinet, which is responsible only to him. He exercises full legislative power, pending the formation of a new parliament, and whenever he thinks foreign tension or serious internal crisis makes it necessary. About the only thing he cannot do without the assent of the legislature is to declare war, but he does have full disposal of the armed forces. While nothing definite is said about the composition of the future parliament, official statements make it clear that it will be corporative. In other words, it will be representative of economic groups, of industries and professions, rather than of territorial units, as in America. Its functions will be advisory, perhaps as shadowy as those of the German Reichstag, although it is still too early to tell definitely. From the statements of those who now rule France, we know something about the kind of nation they would like to set up. In the first place, they would like to change pretty thoroughly the old order, which they regard as responsible for the defeat of the country. This means that the political conflict of the many little parties in the old French Republic, the corruption and the intrigue, the violent disagreement between various classes and groups, the instability of the French cabinet system, that all these things must be wiped out. The first task, then, as the government sees it, is reconstruction, and for reconstruction there must be order. Hence, there will have to be great concentration of authority, for which the new constitution fully provides. The government will dominate all economic life, making free enterprise no more than a memory. In the new, controlled economy, everyone will have to work, and to work hard for subsistence. The trend will turn away from the growth of large industry and labor unions. The country will be encouraged to return to the agricultural and peasant character of old France, a development which would make of France one vast farm territory, dependent on a dominant Nazi Germany for most of its industrial products. This government is to some extent representative of old right-wing forces in France, who have always been insistent on authority. An attempt is being made to build up new loyalties to a type of state very closely akin to those of General Franco in Spain and Premier Mussolini in Italy. Quickly, before the stunning effect of defeat has worn off and the French feel tempted to embark on a desperate revolution. At the same time, Marshal Pétain is obviously a great believer in the unifying force of history. By abolishing the département, or administrative district, into which the French Republic was divided, and by setting up in their place the old provinces under which France was ruled by royalty before 1789, the Marshal seems to be trying to resurrect the ancient glory of France. The historic note is also sounded by the use of Versailles as the French capital, although this is probably due to a desire to be free of the possible fury of the Paris crowd as well. In 1871, too, a new French government, formed after a disastrous defeat, made Versailles its first capital, while Paris rose in the brief but bitter revolution of the Paris Commune. The new government has been called fascist, although its own spokesmen deny the allegation. Any regime in France today would have to rule by a sort of modified martial law until order was brought out of chaos. But this much is certain. The new regime has copied most of its basic principles from the authoritarian governments now existing in Europe. Certainly, its composition indicates anything but a democratic orientation. Marshal Pétain, at 84, is too old to direct the state in person. Active leadership has apparently fallen into the hands of a triumvirate, consisting of Pierre Laval, General Maxime Weygand, and Adrien Marquet. Laval is vice premier and the designated successor to Pétain. He is well known in America as an apostle of appeasement, as the man who cultivated close relations with Mussolini, and, let it not be forgotten, once signed an alliance with Soviet Russia in order to strengthen France against the Reich. He is known as one of the country's wiliest politicians. While France was still in the war, rumors were often heard that he favored peace negotiations with Germany. General Weygand, now defense minister and lieutenant of Foch in the last war, is said to have extreme right-wing views and to be strongly anti-communist. Marquet, mayor of Bordeaux and minister of the interior, is a representative of the French Neo-Socialist Party. This group, now strong at Vichy, broke off from the French Socialist Party in 1933 because the socialist outlook was too international. The neo-socialists were greatly impressed by Hitler's success. They adopted the words order, authority, nation as their slogan and bitterly assailed the ineffectiveness of the French Parliament. By their former socialist colleagues, they were regarded as little short of fascist. Marquet himself was singled out by some as a future leader because of his abrupt manner and fierce look and Hitler mustache. Marcel Déat, another dissident socialist, now prominent at Vichy, carved a niche for himself in French history by asking the French last summer whether they were ready to die for Danzig. Indeed, the men of Munich are all of them in the forefront today, save only Daladier, who has been refused transportation by the Germans from the Moroccan port in which he took refuge. So the government, except for the generals, is a government of men who opposed the war and were not too reluctant to see the fighting halted. This is a government which assented to defeat and submission, headed by men some of whom regard France as an old and decadent nation, not able to stand up to the revitalized totalitarian powers on equal terms. Those holding such fatalistic views feel that the country must accept a temporary eclipse as a great power and go through a long period of adjustment and sacrifice before it can emerge once more. They have been defeatist as far as the conduct of hostilities was concerned. Now they desire to avoid the extermination of France as a nation. And, to them, the best way to do that seems to be to come to terms with the victors at any cost. For this very reason, the Pétain regime may not be able to retain power. It is not led by an outstanding, magnetic personality who can grip the imagination of the masses as Hitler and, to some extent, Mussolini have done. It is led by men carried over from the old order, men who formed some of the cliques which juggled power back and forth in the innumerable cabinets of pre-war days. These are leaders who must themselves bear heavy responsibility for the plight of France today. After the last war and the crises which followed it, Hitler, Mussolini, Kemal in Turkey surged into power at the head of great protest movements against existing conditions. At this moment, the French people, those of them not under the control of German troops, are dazed by the suddenness of events. As their hardships increase, however, despair and fierce determination may produce a new man, and a new French political organization. What form it will finally assume, no one can yet foresee. But evidently, the government means to control the rebirth of French national energy. It is significant that dispatches from Vichy speak of a new political party, which would presumably receive official protection through the Minister of Youth and Family, Jean Ebonnegaray. Ebonnegaray was a leader in the fascist Croix de Feu in the pre-war days, and he and Marcel Déat might well form a new fascist political organization if this should occur, if all other political activity should be forbidden, if French youth, labor, agriculture, and cultural life should all be geared into this new national movement, then indeed, France would have gone totalitarian. Just now, however, the problem of relations with the victors is predominant. Monsieur Pétain and Laval lean toward the formation of a Mediterranean bloc comprising Italy, Spain, and France, which may eventually become a counterweight to Germany. For the present, however, it is Germany which must be courted, since it occupies over half the country. The government's proposal to move back into the occupied territory indicates that cooperation will be attempted. The sharp anti-British tone of the new regime may be motivated by the same purpose, although it unquestionably reflects a deep-rooted feeling that the Anglo-French alliance has not been worthwhile for the French. Dispatches filtering through the censorship hint at anti-Semitic developments and a campaign against the French socialists, both measures calculated to secure better ultimate peace terms from the fascist dictators. If this purpose is really uppermost in the minds of the new rulers of France, however, the attitude of the German press in the last few days will come to them as a rude shock, for the Nazis have reacted sharply to the news that 80 members of the French National Assembly voted against the resolution, giving Pétain full powers to alter the Constitution. Already the Germans have begun to strip the occupied sections of France of foodstuffs, livestock, and all foreign exchange and valuables. Berlin probably senses that the future prospects of the new French government are not good and sees no point in dealing gently with it. And the Nazis intend to impress on the French the fact that Germany alone will be master in the new Europe. The unfolding tragedy of France, then, will be profound. It will be watched with anxiety by all those who have known and loved the country. There will be many postmortems on the Third Republic, and much will be revealed, which may be of assistance to us. Already the principal lessons are clear. No individual was responsible for the debacle, and no single movement. The collapse was a national collapse, affecting the whole people. France was paralyzed by social strife and its social and faulty system of unstable cabinet government. It was not wholehearted in its war effort. Communists on the left conducted anti-war propaganda at Moscow's behest, while extremists on the right flirted with fascism as a means of preserving their own position against the effects of social reforms. The socialists cut down production by raising labor standards too far above those in neighboring countries, and capitalist interests weakened the state by letting industrial plants grow obsolete, while they sent their funds to foreign countries for safekeeping. In the government, politicians and bureaucrats were sometimes corrupt and more often failed to supply the drive and imagination needed to meet the fascist powers on equal terms. Despite these failings, France did make a worthy war effort, which should not be underrated. Its collapse was due to internal disunity, a lack of economic preparedness for war, a faulty military doctrine, and a diplomacy which had disastrous consequences. Its fate today raises questions fundamental for the future of the United States.
You have been listening to Mr. David H. Popper, a staff member of the Research Department of the Foreign Policy Association. If you would like a free copy of this talk, send your request to the Foreign Policy Association, number 8, West 40th Street, New York City. The Foreign Policy Association is a nonpartisan organization open to all who are interested in American foreign policy. It offers accurate information on current world events, and in the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the series America Looks Abroad. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.